You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a new study looking at harmful algae blooms, what the results tell us about climate change and what fixing the problem could look like. Now, little free libraries are all over the place in Wisconsin. There are some parts of the state where it's hard to walk a few blocks without seeing at least one. An artist in Green Bay decided to put her own unique twist on little free libraries by creating a little free art gallery, which is now stationed in front of her home in Green Bay. Amy Zander is a teaching artist based in Green Bay. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure.
Where did the inspiration for your little free art gallery come from?
Well, I've been creating for as long as I can remember, and now as a full-time artist, I get to work from my studio, which is located in my backyard. And I got to experience the little free libraries firsthand with my granddaughters. They have one in their neighborhood, and every time I'd go to visit, the girls would want to go and check it out and see what was inside. But they use theirs for books and DVDs and toys and things like that, and it was lots of goodies, and it was a lot of fun. So I was inspired by that. But I needed to make it my own because our neighborhood is pretty creative and we don't have a lot of children. So I thought filling it with art was the perfect fit for me anyway. And I've heard about a little free art gallery on the East Coast, so I wanted in. They're gaining a little momentum and are popping up all over. And hopefully someday we're going to have just as many little free art galleries as we do the little libraries. Like I said, our neighborhood is pretty creative. So after discussing it with my husband, the project was a go. A few days later, it was my birthday, and my husband told me that he wanted to actually build me one as my birthday gift. So we were off and running.
Okay. So Amy, if I showed up on opening day at your little free art gallery, what would I have found it stocked with?
Actually, I peeked in. It's a lot of fun. Every day I go to design it and move things around and to see what has been chosen to take home and what is new to be dropped off. So this morning there's some paintings in there from me, and some other people had dropped off some things, a fused glass bug that I have dropped off. Knitting is new. We've had a couple of knitted pieces. There's actually a green and gold little pumpkin in there now. Painted stones, photography, ceramic pieces. You know, it's just exciting to see Green Bay embrace this, and all the creative people are coming together and dropping off. You don't have to drop off just to take. You can come look. We've gotten some people that just open the door just to look to see what's going on. Like I said, it's there. If you like it, take it with you. If you are a maker and you feel you'd like to donate something to the gallery, you can leave it in and take something with you. Lots of different options, but the goal of the gallery is just to spread happiness and share, creating smiles, especially during the pandemic. I mean, everybody needs to have something that makes them smile and to go for a walk in our neighborhood and open the door and find something that makes them smile and to be able to take it home just for free, just because, you know, they're out. They took the time to stop and to look, you know, makes me happy.
And you're hoping to inspire people to create also by putting, I understand, some art supplies that people could take from the art gallery.
Absolutely. As a teaching artist, it's important to me to encourage people to give art a try. So inside of the gallery, I have a small little basket of art supplies like markers, crayons, paper, pencils, you know, that type of thing. So how long has it been since you've had a crayon in your hand?
When I was probably taking it away from one of my kids, I'll say, when they were drawing on the wrong thing.
And I even have paper in there, and just a fun little thing. I opened up the gallery one morning and somebody had took one of the sheets of paper from that little box and made a little origami frog out of it. So they took the time to do it. So it was really cool. I also have an Instagram page for it, which is gaining momentum. So at Little Free Art Gallery GB. And I had one of the followers on my Instagram page actually contact me, and she sent me a painting all the way from Maryland that she wanted to share as an artist with my little gallery. So yeah, it was in there. It only lasted, you know, like a day. And somebody spotted it and took it home. But, you know, we're spreading art all over and, you know, taking the opportunity to, you know, spread some smiles and giving with the little supplies that are in there too. Chalk art is in there too. So if you don't have something at home to give it a try, you know, stop by, and there's always something in there to get the creativity flowing. It's a lot of fun.
Amy, I think a lot of people might think of, when they hear the phrase art class, they think of something they did when they were a kid in school. Can you make the case that us grown-ups can get something out of taking a class or just trying some creativity on our own at home.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, my husband who built the art gallery for me, I mean, it's even got a shingled roof on it. I said, okay, even though that you created the gallery for me, you need to put something inside. So he just drew a face and took a piece of my watercolor paper that I had in the studio and just a smiley face, you know, two eyes, a nose, a smile, a little square. It was about 2-inch square. He put it in and what took a little longer, but maybe like 5 days later, it was gone. You should have seen the happy hands that he did. It's just that simple. Kids art. You know, my first actually donation to the Little Free Art Gallery was from my granddaughter, who's 4. So it's not just for adults. Art is everywhere. Like I said, if you can hold a pencil and doodle, it's in. Absolutely.
Amy, before I let you go, are you hoping that other people will run with this idea in other neighborhoods around Green Bay, other communities around the state?
Yes, absolutely. Sharing art, the art community is huge. All of us, you know, we're made out of the same cloth, and we all love to share our art with others. And I think I'm the first one in quite a distance around here. I think we've been getting lots of feedback. But absolutely, if anybody's got any questions and wants to know how to do it, you know, contact me. You can follow me on my website if you want to know more information about me. AmyZander.com is an easy way to reach me if you've got any questions about starting your own. It's a lot of fun. We're on Facebook too, Amy Zander Studio on Facebook. You can reach me that way too. And it's just fun. Everybody needs to have a smile and to feel good. Absolutely.
Amy, thanks so much for sharing your art and sharing your project with us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Amy Zander, a teaching artist in Green Bay who has created a little free art gallery outside of her home. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about having the gift of seeing spirits.
Everyone likes a good ghost story, especially around this time of year. Dorothy Malone of Milwaukee shared a childhood encounter with the supernatural at Xfabula's Story Slam Identity event held in March of 2020.
I was a little girl, and I was able to see ghosts. I could see them all the time, everywhere. Someone told me that if you throw salt over your shoulders, that would get rid of them. So I got every box of Morton salt I can find and just tossing them. Now I'm going down this dark hallway. I see a white shadowy figure. So now I'm cursing, not again. You know, and I'm like, oh my God. So I'm trembling at about 10 years old. And I have heard that they cannot hurt you. You only can hurt yourself. Oh, that was, now I'm running in the walls, falling down the stairs, you know, outside at 3 o'clock in the morning. So as time went on, I heard that poltergeists will leave children by the time they're 13 years old. So I can't wait till I'm 13. I just can't wait. I mean, hurry up, you know, because all this time these ghosts are effing with me. So someone said, oh, if you curse them out, then they'll leave. So now I'm having a field day. Leave me to hell. My mother said, whoa, what's going on in there? So that didn't last too long because I got spanked. You know, I got whipped. You know, I'll be using that mouthwash, ivory soap, and all of that. But I'm thinking this would have the ghost leave me alone. Now, here I am at 13. No ghosts. I'm like, oh my God, they're gone, only to have one hovering above my bed. Now, I get the blanket, throw it over it, and give me the look. Go somewhere. I don't want to see you no more. It was howling too while it was up, but then I was doing all I beat this shit out of. But I learned I have a gift, and part of my identity is that I could, in black terms, read people. I can tell a little bit about your spirit by talking to you. I can tell, you know, you can't play a player, so I know if you're trying me, then I can tell that, you know. And I just have a way with babies. They would just look at me and like, that's a good person, that's the good one right there. And the little kids be like, a compliment all the time. I like your glasses. I like your wig. I'm like, thank you. going through that experience and always trying to find a meaning in life or why I'm here, or looking to the cosmos for my existence, I think that had a part in it growing up with these ghostly images all around me. But today, you know, I'm at peace with them. I don't fear them as much. And that's my story.
Dorothy Malone's story comes to us from Exfabula, a storytelling organization based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, a new study from a UW lake researcher had a surprising finding about harmful algae blooms when it comes to climate change. We'll get the details and what it tells us about how we can protect the health of lakes here in the state. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, when we're talking about algae in lakes, there can be good kinds and bad kinds. It can be a vital photosynthesizing component of an underwater ecosystem, or it can multiply wildly and be toxic to people and animals in and around the water. So the more we can learn about why these harmful algae blooms happen, the more we can do to prevent them. Our next guest looked at the impact of climate change on those blooms and found less of a link than previously thought. Grace Wilkinson is an assistant professor at the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Grace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on.
Well, before we get into your research on climate change and these algae blooms, can you talk about why these algae blooms, the bad kinds, are such a big deal in our lakes?
Yeah, absolutely. So algal blooms are really bad for the health of lake ecosystems, particularly when there's just a lot of algal growth. So we probably all know those times where we've looked at a lake and it sort of looks like pea soup, or it's really green. And of course, they're not pleasant to be around either. They smell bad. They look terrible. It's not fun to be on that lake boating or recreating or just to be around it. And as you mentioned, some blooms also produce toxins, and those can be very harmful to humans as well as our pets and other wildlife. And so we really don't want these harmful algal blooms to be around in our lakes.
We hear people talking about blue-green algae or cyanobacteria. That's one of the ones we really worry about, right?
Absolutely. And some of those taxa or species of cyanobacteria can produce those toxins that we worry so much about and are often monitoring our waters for.
The thinking has been that climate change, generally warmer weather, was going to make these algae blooms worse and more common. Again, before we get to your research, why did we think that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just like us humans, often algae really like it when it's warm, right? So they enjoy the hot weather, the warm temperatures. They can grow faster, acquire nutrients faster, all of those processes that they do to grow. And so if temperatures are rising, it's going to make the waters warmer, and the algae really like that. It also tends to make the water a bit more stable. So in terms of the warm water at the top of the lake, or what we refer to as the epilimneon, versus the colder water in the bottom, it tends to keep those layers really strongly stratified, and the algae really benefit from that as well. And so for a while, lake scientists have suspected that blooms would be getting worse in lakes because of these rising temperatures.
So you tried to figure out, okay, is this really happening? How did you do that?
Yeah, so my colleagues and I really wanted to know if our perceptions and our ideas about how blooms might have been changing over the past few decades was actually matched by the data. And so we looked around at a number of different state agencies and other databases that had been put together, and we found over 300 lakes that had data on the algal amount of algae in the water, what we call the algal biomass, that had over the past decade. So these were data sets that had been collected by state agencies, by volunteers, by other academic scientists like myself, for at least the past decade, measuring the amount of algal biomass in the lake. And we looked at those over 300 lakes to examine whether or not there were any trends or how algal blooms were changing. Were they getting worse, more intense, more severe? Were they staying the same, or were they actually getting better?
And
what we found, surprisingly, was about 1 in 10 lakes, so about 11% of lakes, are getting worse. Algal blooms were intensifying. So maybe they were increasing in their severity, or they were sticking around longer, their duration was longer. But what we found, and was very surprising to us, was that actually 1 out of 6 lakes, or about 16%, are getting significantly better. So more lakes actually have algal blooms becoming less intense than more intense. And that was, of course, very surprising to us, because we had assumed that because temperatures are rising all over the globe, that we would see that algal blooms are getting worse in most lakes.
Talking to Grace Wilkinson with the UW-Madison Center for Limnology, looking at harmful algae blooms in our lakes here in the state and the role climate change might play in making it worse. Maybe it's not, at least so far, it looks like from this research. So, Grace, climate change isn't the variable, what is it, do we think, that might make a lake over there get worse over time, a lake over here get better over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so we wanted to dig in a little bit more to try to understand that exact thing. Why were lakes responding so differently to what seemed like a driver that was happening everywhere, climate change? We did find some evidence, but it was mostly anecdotal, that water quality policies, so things like the Clean Water Act, may be helping lakes that are getting better. But unfortunately, we couldn't explicitly include those in our models and our analysis, just because there's not enough concrete data out there. There's not a central repository where lake managers put in the information about what's happening in their watersheds or their lakes. So that's really hard to get at. And we actually had to rely a lot on local news stations and newspapers for stories about lake restoration that was happening. So we have some evidence of that. But I think more interestingly, what we did find was a really interesting interaction between extreme storms, so extreme precipitation events, and lakes that were already really rich in nutrients. So algae really love nutrients. It helps them grow. They need that phosphorus and that nitrogen. And so lakes that already have a lot of that, if the storms that occur during the summer are getting more and more severe and more extreme, then those lakes were more likely to be getting worse algal blooms over time. But in the same sort of lake that was nutrient rich, but storms were actually getting less and less intense over the summer, those lakes were more likely to be getting substantially better in terms of algal blooms. So while it's not this temperature climate change hypothesis that we all were assuming was going to be at play, there is sort of this interaction in terms of climate change and how it's changing our precipitation patterns or our storms. And that's certainly something that we're experiencing right here in Wisconsin.
When it comes to human contributions to these algae blooms in our lakes, are there things we know that make things worse, or at least raise the potential to make things worse, the sorts of things we do in a watershed?
Absolutely. So nutrient inputs, that nitrogen and phosphorus into lakes, are what's fueling those algal blooms. And so everything that we can do to control those nutrient inputs is really important. So we often refer to that as eutrophication, or the additional enrichment of nutrients in the water. And so any way that we can control the nutrients that we're putting onto land, or control that those nutrients that we are putting onto the land not getting into lakes, is really important. So whether those are sources in agricultural land uses, or it's urban waste, it's septic systems, all of those things contribute. And in particular, once phosphorus gets into the lakes, it gets stored into the sediments and is then slowly released again over time. And so this legacy phosphorus that's stored down in the sediments can help fuel algal blooms, even if no nutrients were added from the surrounding watershed. And so it's really important to be thinking about what we can do now to control nutrients, because it's going to help now, but it's also going to be a long-term process as that phosphorus that's stored in the sediments of some of these lakes continues to fuel blooms. So it's a long road ahead, and the interaction of this and storms, or that component of climate change, more extreme storms, is really going to be changing in the future as well. And so we need to be adaptive in how we manage our nutrients, not just what we're doing now and is working, but what's going to work in the future because of these extreme storms.
Well, let me throw, a good news read on your research here, Grace. If climate change was making all lakes inexorably worse over the years, that might tell, you know, a local community there's not much you can do about algae blooms in your lake. But if I'm hearing you right, this isn't happening with climate change. So actions taken at that local level in a lake's watershed can make a difference. Does that sound reasonable?
Absolutely. Actions at the local level and in a watershed that reduce nutrient inputs into the lake are always going to be helpful. And I think what our study helps identify are those lakes that are maybe a little bit more at risk or susceptible to changing and getting worse based on what we've seen in the recent past. And so we can identify those lakes and put more of our very limited resources, perhaps, towards monitoring and managing those ecosystems and being better freshwater stewards. And it might also help identify some of the lakes where we don't need to be as concerned. We still need to keep a watchful eye, but maybe not put as much of our resources because those lakes might not be as much at risk.
In just our last half minute, Grace, what's the next mystery you're hoping to solve when it comes to algae and lakes?
Yeah. So I think these are exciting trends, but what we found are patterns over these 300 lakes. And so our next challenge is to really dig into the why and try to understand, just like you were saying, why this lake and not that lake is getting worse. And I think we have some exciting opportunities in the near future to be doing that and trying to understand in particular how to be better managers and freshwater stewards by answering that question.
Grace, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Grace Wilkinson, assistant professor at the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. We talked to her today about the new results of a study she led looking at harmful algae blooms in water ecosystems and whether climate change has had anything to do with their growth. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, nursing home residents can have a difficult time voting. A Wisconsin sheriff argues that the rules were bent in at least one facility. A disability rights advocate joins the show to look at the best ways to make voting accessible. And young adults are getting married at a lower rate than they used to, and those single adults may be taking an economic hit along the way. We'll take a look at the past, present, and future of marriage and money, and you could join in maybe with your own story. You can let us know now at the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, fluctuating Great Lakes levels are forcing Wisconsin shoreline communities to spend lots of money protecting their real estate. We'll talk to a pair of journalists producing a three-part series on that subject for Wisconsin Watch. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republican candidate for governor Rebecca Clayfish is urging the GOP to harvest ballots in order to defeat Democrats in next year's midterms, claiming that Democrats are already doing it. Another prominent Republican and potential primary opponent says that's, quote, as dumb as a bag of hammers. We'll dive into what ballot harvesting is and isn't coming up. First, Wisconsin is estimated to spend at least several hundred million dollars over the next 5 years on dealing with coastal damage around the Great Lakes. That's out of about $2 billion in the same period that the overall Great Lakes region could spend. Those numbers come from a survey of lake-adjacent U.S. and Canadian mayors, as reported in a new Wisconsin Watch piece published over the weekend. It's the first in a three-part series looking at fluctuating water levels and the impacts on shorelines and shoreline communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have front row seats to this story, living in a community that's been affected by low water levels in recent years or then high water levels on or near any of the Great Lakes? What have you seen? What's the damage, if any, been like? What kind of things are happening in your community to try to deal with this and get ready for the future? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mario Curran is an investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch and wrote the piece, "The Water Always Wins, Calls to Protect Shorelines as Volatile Lake Michigan Inflicts Heavy Toll." Mario, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Miles Danhausen is a content editor for the Peninsula Pulse and Door County Living and has partnered with Wisconsin Watch on this project. Miles, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk, want to talk a little bit about this collaborative project here. Mario, can you tell us how this came to be, bringing together a bunch of news organizations to tackle these shoreline problems?
Yeah, so this project came out of a Wisconsin Watch collaborative we call the New News Lab, which is a collaboration between six outlets in northeastern Wisconsin, the Fox Valley area. We're covering issues that are front and center for the people that are living there. Another thing that was put this story on our radar is the Department of Natural Resources recently embarked on a Door County, or excuse me, a strategic analysis of Door County. So they're really trying to get a grasp on how shoreline communities are managing the shorelines up and down the peninsula, excuse me, the peninsula coast. So Miles has been a great supporter, as well as the Pulse, as we've put together these stories.
And Miles, you're in Door County. That's a lot of coastline. I imagine the opportunity to tackle this issue, this is something that's really important to people in your community, right?
Yeah, this is incredibly important. I mean, it's hard to go into any conversation without this coming up at some point, especially when the water levels were so high a couple of years ago. And then when they go low, like they did in 2013, you know, everybody's very scared about losing their beaches and losing their shoreline. And the thing that draws so many visitors to Door County and kind of drives our economic engine. But yeah, to have the opportunity to have someone like Mario and the folks from Wisconsin Watch to help us dig into this and do some real in-depth reporting was a great opportunity for us here at the Pulse.
And Mario, let's talk about those fluctuations, because they're at the heart of the story here. We had years of pretty low water levels in Lake Michigan, and then really pretty quickly after that, record high water levels. Can you talk about how those swings in general are kind of sending communities on the shoreline back and forth?
Right. So water has fluctuated on Lake Michigan for the past 100 years, at least. We know that by looking at data from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But what's happened in recent years is that the swings have happened quite dramatically. So in 2013, we were looking at record low waters. And, you know, at the time, coming off several years of low water, people thought that's just kind of what we had in store for the next, for the foreseeable future. But within 6 years, that water shot up and shot up dramatically. So we had a swing of about 6 feet between 2013 and 2020. And that, you know, has startled even seasoned ferry boat captains, contractors, people living along the lakeshore there, just by how fast those changes were made.
And Miles, you mentioned in Door County, this is a popular topic of conversation. Can you talk about what it's meant for people in their daily lives, in their property on the shoreline to have, you know, first to deal with those low levels and then all of a sudden high levels just a year or two later?
Yeah, I mean, you had people like take the Village of Ephraim, which is hugely popular for its beautiful kind of picturesque shoreline and the homes in that region. Well, when there was low water levels, you could walk out almost 100 yards into the bay there and walk on the sand. And then you had grasses growing up kind of where normally there'd be water. And so then you have municipalities like that have to deal with dredging to access the shoreline from boats, to have their piers be available to all the boaters up here and marinas available. And then just 6 years later, they're all dealing with putting up new revetments and cinder blocks along those piers just to protect the boats and to protect shoreline properties and homes. In fact, a couple of years ago, the Village of Ephraim had to sandbag around the historic town hall just to keep water out of the basement and protect these buildings. So it's, and then the Anderson Dock and Hardy Gallery, which those familiar with Door County will know as the old building that's graffitied, that's kind of famous for the graffiti on the barn on the pier in Ephraim. They were worried last winter that a big storm might just rip that building right off the pier, that they might have to protect that. So it, you know, low water causes its problems and high water causes its problems, and there's a lot of money at stake.
We're talking to Miles Danhausen with the Peninsula Pulse and Door County Living, and Mario Coran, investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch, about a new series on the impact of up and down lake levels on Lake Michigan in particular and what it means for the communities along those coasts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live or work in one of those communities, what are you seeing where you live? What kind of efforts has your local community put in to deal with low water levels, then high water levels? If you are a tourist who ends up on those shores often yourself, what have you seen from year to year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mario, okay, if a community is sandbagging one year, but it had to dredge the year before. That doesn't seem like a really sustainable way to have to ping pong back and forth. What kind of conversations are there about sustainable approaches to this?
Well, it's really about, as I've talked to mayors and city leaders, it's really about, you know, trying to address the urgent needs, the places that have been damaged by high water, which isn't an easy task when you're trying to, you know, keep city services running, garbage, police, and also try to budget for these repairs that are needed. There has been conversations about planning for the future, but in the near term, it's more about plugging the holes that need that investment right now.
And Miles, what kind of things are you seeing other local communities in your area try to do with that sustainability in mind to try to get ready for possible future fluctuations?
Yeah, I mean, what you're asking is a question that I keep coming back to up here as I watch it year after year, and I've lived here all my life and reported on this for most of the last 15 years. Is at what point do you just let nature take its course and stop spending all this money one year to deal with the low water, all this money the next year to deal with the high water? And we do it throughout the state. It's not just a Door County thing, but it is a lot of money trying to manipulate nature. I mean, you even go back to the city of Chicago when they reversed the flow of the river there. We've done a lot of different things along all of the coastline of the Great Lakes to try and make it fit our needs. And at some point you have to ask, should we be fitting nature's needs to some degree? In Door County, you have the Village of Ephraim has done a shoreline revetment program, kind of, and revetment just means basically those rocks and boulders that you put along the shoreline or steel pilings to try and protect shoreline. Almost the entire stretch of the village in some way, shape, or form between the municipality and private homeowners doing the same thing. And that's something that you're seeing up and down the peninsula. And that's something that Mario revealed in his reporting, is just the number of permits and the number of different property owners taking steps to do this. And when one property owner does something, it has downstream impacts on the neighbors or neighboring municipalities. So nobody lives in a silo here. If somebody next to you puts up a big rock wall, it shovels the problem and shovels the lake down to your shoreline. And then you're kind of forced to follow suit.
We're talking to Miles Danhausen from the Peninsula Pulse and Mario Caran from Wisconsin Watch about a new investigative series they've worked on together for Wisconsin Watch, looking at shoreline communities, how they've been responding to big changes in Great Lakes water levels, low levels, very low levels for a while there, then a record high level. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching this story, maybe living this story firsthand in your community? What's your perspective? How has it impacted you or someone you know? A lot of people and a lot of communities are spending money trying to protect their own area. But who should pay for protection? What kind of solutions do you want to see? Or do you have a question about what's going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Wisconsin Watch investigative reporter Mario Caran and Peninsula Pulse editor Miles Danhausen, looking at a new collaborative project focusing on shoreline communities in the Great Lakes region, feeling the effects of changing lake levels, spending lots of money to deal with those changes, likely to spend a lot more in the years to come. You can join in if you'd like, if you've seen this firsthand, at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this affecting your own home, your vacation home, your town, your city, your favorite travel destination? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mario, you feature the mayor of Sheboygan, the young mayor of Sheboygan, part of a coalition of Great Lakes leaders working to protect shorelines. What kind of things did you hear from that mayor?
Well, I heard Mayor Sorensen echo some of the challenges that we talked about earlier. That's, you know, trying to budget for some of these major repairs that are needed while keeping the city budget moving and keeping those services going. You know, Mayor Sorensen talked a lot about the need for cities to work across the region to work together collaboratively to try to be able to take advantage or secure some federal funds, local and state funds to make these repairs possible, because some of them's in, you know, some of the the dollars we're talking into the millions, which just might be too much for a mid-sized city like Sheboygan and even smaller towns up up along the shores of Lake Michigan. So it's really a collaborative approach trying to raise their collective voice and also trying to streamline the process for making federal and state dollars available or securing them when they are available.
Miles, do you hear this as a budget concern from leaders on Door County?
Absolutely. You know, you take a village like Ephraim, and even though Door County has the advantage of some very high property values that generate, you know, good money for local budgets, not many people budget for the kind of work that Ephraim had to undertake the last couple of years, spending several hundred thousand dollars on shoreline improvements. So now some of that is being taken from the countywide room tax that was implemented about 12 years ago to help promote tourism and shore up tourism infrastructure. Some of that money goes back to the individual municipalities to use however they want. So it has proven to become pretty fortuitous for Door County that they have that room tax, because now that 30% that goes back to these towns is helping them deal with some of these problems. They've also had to go after some of that those federal emergency grants and funding. And you have, these are small towns. I mean, Village of Ephraim is a couple of hundred people. Village Vague Harbor is about 200 people. So there's, these are small governments trying to deal with pretty big problems, pretty expensive problems, and finding out the right way to do it, because it's not as simple as like every shoreline is the same. This is not a one product solution. There are all sorts of different ways to fix some of these problems on your shoreline, but it's pretty complicated. And you're having small governments that don't have huge parks departments or huge municipal staffs to oversee these projects.
And Miles, is there a concern that this could threaten tourism in the area if people are worried that their, you know, their favorite beach or beach home isn't going to be available to them?
Well, I will say, especially during the low water years, mm-hmm. that was a really huge concern here. The beaches were more or less gone because they were grassed over. They basically had turned into lawns in a lot of places. And then we have a beach called Sand Bay that was basically all grass. And then now with the high lake levels, you lose the beach in a different way. Whereas last year, basically Whitefish Dunes Beach, which is probably by most measures, the most beautiful beach in Door County, was completely gone. There was no beach to speak of at all. And last summer, Rock Island State Park, one of the most remote and beautiful state parks in Wisconsin in the whole system, was closed all summer because you couldn't access the small dock there to even bring people to Rock Island. So there are a lot of different impacts. And, you know, if you're a tourist destination and people come here for a certain thing and that thing is not available, that's going to hurt you in the long run.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Shauna is with us in Iron River. Shauna, hi.
Hi there. I was just calling with a couple comments because I spent 2018 paddling around Lake Superior, actually by kayak, and I live pretty close to the lake anyway, so have seen this before, but it was a really interesting perspective. I think the water levels maybe were even higher than they are now in Lake Superior. And it was interesting to see, first of all, that a lot of the beaches and stopping resting areas that I had been researching and learning about from other people were basically gone because the water levels were so high. So I kind of had to factor those changes into my trip. And then, of course, too, especially along Whitefish Bay, but other areas as well, there were just miles upon miles of brand new riprap with, you know, the big boulders or steel that had just gone in. And it kind of struck me that if weather turned, there was really no way to get off the water because so much of the shoreline now had been just turned into steel and huge boulders with no smooth access. And then the last thing, I've seen a lot of this, the sloughs happen in the area that I live in on the south shore of Lake Superior. But as I was paddling, I mean, there was one house that I saw that was still being built. There were, the stickers were literally still on the brand new windows, and a recent slough that had happened brought the house within like 30 feet of where the lake was now. And I just thought, like, the lake is going to win and zoning is just failing these people that are building this new, you know, million-dollar house.
Shauna, wow. Thank you for sharing that perspective from the water. And I imagine you focus on Lake Michigan, Mario, but I imagine somebody kayaking on Lake Michigan might have seen, especially in 2018, a lot of what Shauna saw.
Right. The lakes are separate. Each has their specific issues that they're dealing with. Lake Superior, too, we know, saw many of the same issues, swinging water levels. They're also seeing, you know, increased requests for permits. And, you know, that's one of the things Shauna touched on was the hardening of the shoreline. And just in the recent years, past 3-4 years, we've seen those numbers soar. The request for permits on, and again, this was looking at Lake Michigan, but the request for permits to build these shoreline structures went up by 144%. The emergency self-certifications, which is a temporary permit to build when your home is being threatened, that shot up by 830%. So these numbers are really soaring. And, you know, to her point, to Shauna's point about seeing, you know, the visible impact along the shoreline, I mean, that's borne out in the numbers, certainly.
Shauna, thanks a lot for that call. And Miles, Shauna mentioned zoning. Is there talk in Door County of saying, hey, let's maybe build our houses a little further than we thought we needed to in the past, away from the shore?
Well, that is what some, I don't want to call it activists, but some people would say is like, well, there is a fix for this. Stop building right on the water. And there have been some new rules and new setback requirements that have been put in recent years to push people to develop further from the shoreline. Obviously, some property owners really hate that. There are people who have bought shorefront property thinking that they could just tear down the cottage or the home that was there and build whatever they wanted. And then they are kind of abruptly hit with the news that, no, you can't just build right up to the shore, and you can't build a boathouse or a dock house anymore in Door County like you could maybe on some inland lakes or other parts of the country where every home, like say Asheville, outside of Asheville in Lake Lure, pretty much every home has a little boathouse on the water. If you did that in Door County along these shores, if they allowed you to do that everywhere, you would have a lot of people applying for emergency funding to either save or rebuild those, because in recent years, when you get those storms, those would have been torn apart.
Thanks again for that call, Shauna. Mario, this is all part one of a three-part series. Can you give us a preview of what's coming up the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, so the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be taking a closer look at the shoreline erosion, some of what Shauna talked about, some of what we talked about earlier in the call, but really zeroing in and taking a look at how the wildly fluctuating lake levels are accelerating parts of erosion, and accelerating erosion along much of the coastline, and what the impacts of that are. We're also going to be taking a look at state parks and what they've been grappling with, some of the damage that has happened from high water over the years, some of what's at stake with public land. So that's some of what's in store for us in the weeks ahead.
And Miles, as we wrap up, you mentioned this is a hot topic of conversation on Door County. Are you hoping that the series opens the eyes of the people inland here in the state to what's going on the shorelines?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we are privileged in a way to have this problem, to live in a place that has this beautiful coastline where I can wake up and go 3 minutes to see the sunrise over the water on one side of the peninsula and 3 minutes in the other direction to see it set. And I know that a lot of the state probably, you know, just sees us as a privileged group up here. And that is true in some instances. But these are small towns, like many of the others throughout the state, that most of the year are very small populations, and then they have to grapple with these big problems. So it is, you know, it's tax dollars. It's the same thing that other communities grapple with, but in some cases on a much higher dollar figure.
We'll leave it there. Miles, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for talking about this topic.
And Mario, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
That's Mario Coran, investigative reporter for Wisconsin Watch, and Miles Danhausen, content editor for the Peninsula Pulse and Door County Living. We talked to him about a new Wisconsin Watch piece they've worked on. Part one came out over the weekend, looking at shoreline erosion around the Great Lakes region. You can find the first piece, called The Water Always Wins, up online at wisconsinwatch.org. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest developments involving ballots at Racine Nursing Homes, and we'll check in on the Republican race for governor and ballot issues going on being brought up there. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.